Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. Welcome to another fantastic episode here. And today's guest is Mr. Adam Pierno, Chief Strategy Officer for Santee. But Adam wasn't always a Chief Strategy Officer. He was an art and creative director in his 20-year history in advertising. And Adam is the author of the book Underthink It, a marketing strategy guidebook for everyone. Basically kind of walking you through the way to create strategy for those who do not have a background in that area. So today on the show, Mr. Adam Pierno, Chief Strategy Officer of Santee. Also, please follow my blog post either on my website or I think it's a predominant place, or actually they're being posted to Medium, Thrive Global as well. Essentially, this, I think it's 16-part series, I can't remember what I have, is all excerpts from my book coming across this. And I just found out today that Dr. Marshall Goldsmith is going to endorse my book. So if you don't know who he is, Google him. He at different times has been ranked as the number one leadership expert in the world. So I could not be more thrilled. All right, and listen to and also if you want to get the full interview, go to my website. It will be posted there later today or tomorrow. And YouTube, go there. Okay, too many places for you. But enjoy this episode today, Mr. Adam Pierno. See you. All right, today on Executives After Hours, I have the pleasure to talk with Adam Pierno. Adam, can you please say hello? Say hi.
I can. Hello, hi. Okay. All of those things. I'm capable of saying those things.
You are bilingual already. And can you...
Yeah, here we go.
Can you tell my audience where you're at and what you do?
Absolutely. Yeah. I am calling in from Scottsdale, Arizona in beautiful US and A. And I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at Santee, which is an ad agency based in Scottsdale with an office in Brea, California as well. We're about 50 people. And our whole business is really to find change that's affecting our clients and figure out how to turn that into a lever to grow their business.
Through branding and marketing strategy?
Yeah, and through anything that we think we can throw at the wall and make meaningful business impact. So I focus on the strategy side, but we are full service. So if it's a media impact, if it's a creative impact, if it's just a behavioral impact that we notice out in the world or a technology, we find those gaps where the competitors are missing something and we go, you know, dive into that change and bring it to our clients to help them with their business.
So how long have you been at Santee?
Oh, this is my second stint here. So I've been back since 2014. I did 4 years as the creative director. And then I moved to Atlanta to explore some other career opportunities. And then we came back after about 2.5 years. And I've been back for almost 4 years now as the strategy director and chief strategy officer.
And so, you know, in your journey, we don't all start at chief strategy officer. So maybe you did. I don't know. Maybe you're the anomaly.
I sure did not.
Okay. So where are you originally from?
Yeah. So originally, I mean, I grew up in Long Island, New York. Beautiful, scenic Long Island, New York.
You don't even have an accent. Like in my head, Long Islanders have an accent.
No, my family has it, but I shed it. I moved to Boston for college. I went to Boston U. And go Terriers. And I lived in Boston for 10 years. And so somehow I kind of shed the accent from Long Island, and I never picked up the Massachusetts accent, thank God. It's charming, but it kind of wears on you after a while.
Is it like a little bit less than nails on the chalkboard?
I love it because I feel like, you know, during my formative years, the 10 years I lived there as an adult, I came to love it, and the people there are just so awesome. But it's when you hear people out of context and you just hear that accent, kid, you're like, yeah, oh, bless her heart.
And so what was it like growing up on Long Island? I had a roommate from Long Island in college, and he was like this hustler. He's now like a New York NYPD detective, but he was like this hustler. So I have this image of this Irish Catholic, you know, he's an Irish Catholic kid. And he was I just keep going back to the word hustler because that's all I could think of when I saw him. He just had angles and he would work it, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of, that's funny that you say that. There's a lot of angles and there's a lot of people like looking for an angle or looking for a way in. But I mean, it was really, we were just on the edge of Queens. Mm-hmm. But it was really a nice, you know, suburban upbringing. Everything was nice. Went to a decent school.
Was it a Catholic school? Because isn't Boston U Catholic or is it Boston College?
No, Boston College is, it's not Catholic. It is Jesuit.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah, Boston U is strongly atheist.
Wow, you say that with such like vigor. Like,
I just think it's funny. I just think it's funny that they have no allegiance to any. They have a church right in the middle of campus, but it's like a non-denominational, you know, it's just like an open-ended, come in and worship whatever God you want to worship, even if it's artificial intelligence.
So now growing up in Long Island or Queens or either one of those two are on the borough, what was like what was your family life like? I mean, did you have brothers and sisters?
We're going back this far. Yeah. I have two older brothers and they're 8 and 6 years older than me. So there was a little bit of separation. I was kind of a whoops. I didn't have that close thing, but I got close to my middle brother as we got a little bit older and we had more in common.
So how would you describe yourself in like a birth order combination? I'm always interested because I describe myself kind of in a certain way because I was the youngest by 5 years. And so...
I'm the baby for sure. Yeah. And I think I have some of those behaviors. Now I have two kids myself. And so I kind of observe and see if that plays out with my own kids. I only have two, so I don't have a middle one to really judge models against. But I do see that younger kid gets spoiled. And I know I was spoiled too.
Did you ever also like consider yourself an only child at the same time?
No, I kind of had the benefit of both of my older brothers, you know, had kind of blazed a trail ahead of me. They were popular in school. One of them was like,
so are
really
you saying
big
you were
guy.
Popular? Like you were a popular kid in school?
No, I was not a popular kid at all. I was a dork. But because of their reputation, I got to skate on a lot of stuff that I would probably get bullied for. But it was like, oh, yeah, but he's Dean's brother. So just let it go. You know, even if he wants to go play Dungeons and Dragons, it's OK. this time it's OK.
So
I got a lot of free passes.
So for me, you know, I was the youngest by five and I had two older brothers and we all swam and we all played water polo and I looked nothing like my brothers. My mom was married before. So those, my two brothers, like half brothers. So anyhow, I always felt like I was an only child. So definitely youngest tendencies, babied, all that stuff, but super only child, like left to my own devices, did my own thing.
I did too. And I can remember a lot of free time just playing with Lego for hours and hours and hours. And I can remember I was a latchkey kid, which I don't
Me
think
too.
That even, does that even exist anymore?
I know, right?
But whatever. I was a latchkey kid and I can remember coming in after school when I was a latchkey kid.
Yeah. Like what was the earliest?
Starting in like fourth, fifth grade.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I could just remember coming home and having, you know, free time, mapping my day out for myself. So coming home and figuring out if I was going to do my homework or play or go around the block and find some kids to play with. It's looking back on it when seeing my own family, it's like, wow, I would never allow, that. But it was a different time. It was acceptable then. And looking back, I got through it without any major problems.
It was funny. My parents, I was a latchkey kid, third grade. It's not a competition. I'm not saying I'm better than you because of that. but in third grade, I was a Lasky kid. And I had like three rules. One, eat what's in the fridge for a snack. Two, don't go outside. And three, don't burn the house down.
Burn the house down was a, yeah, that was definitely a rule we had as well. Yeah, I succeeded. I didn't do it. Where did you grow up? What part of the country?
I grew up in Oregon, Portland, Oregon.
Oh, okay. All right. So the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, it's for me, it's really interesting to meet other individuals who are latchkey kids, because at an early age, you're really given this ultimate freedom and independence when you're still trying to figure that out. Right.
And yeah, I think it's a really valuable and underappreciated developmental tool. So it's like, what are you going to do at that time? Are you just going to go home and watch TV? Or now, I didn't have the internet because it didn't exist. But now, would you just
go
home? Thank
God. What would you do on the internet now?
I'd just either be playing video games or be visiting websites I definitely should not be visiting.
Exactly. So. But do you also think, you know, and I don't know this, I'm just kind of thinking about myself, but I was thinking about some of the outcomes of the independence that I was given at a young age. And one of the probably positive attributes is that I just get shit done, right? Like, I'm just kind of a doer. Right. And I had to solve problems when I was a kid. But the other side of it, though, is I'm really bad at asking for help. And I don't know if that's a cultural thing or if that's because at such a young age, I didn't rely on anybody to solve my problems.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have the same traits and I don't know if that's why, but I'm definitely self-motivated and self-directed. And if someone tells me, you know, if my boss or a client says, hey, this is the end result I want, I'll just go chase that down and figure out how to do it. But at the same time, if I realize like, oh, I could really use a hand, I'm like, yeah, but if I bring them in, then I'm going to have to slow down and explain everything. And then I'm going to have to wait 3 days for their work. And I make all these excuses for why I don't want to do that, which is terrible because I'm in a leadership position. And part of my job is to bring more people in and make the work better. So it's something I do have to be mindful of and pay attention. Like, oh, nope. Why are you making that excuse? Time out. We're going to think about this and figure out how we're going to get to the result we need.
So now what did your parents do that made you a latchkey kid so young?
My dad worked most of my childhood. He worked at a hospital leading the x-ray department.
Okay.
And the hospital was really close to the house. And then my mom worked at a doctor's office really early on. And then she worked at a lab, a veterinary blood lab.
Yeah, yeah.
So they would do, you know, all the vets would send in their blood work to this lab and it's turned into this big national company. So she helped manage that office.
So usually when someone works in healthcare, they have a level of compassion. So would you describe your parents as compassionate people, at least towards others?
Oh, no. Yeah. And to me. Yeah. My parents are both very highly compassionate, highly empathetic. Really patient, much more patient than I am. So, yeah.
Do you see yourself as compassionate? Do you see yourself as compassionate at all? Like a learned trait from your parents?
I am working on being more empathetic and more compassionate. I'm a real bottom line person.
Yeah.
And so something I've been working on for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like results, right? We were given a task. Did we succeed or fail? And there's easy, especially in the marketing industry where, let's face it, there's a lot of gray area and I can find the data to make any case I want to make. And I have a team of analysts who will find that data for me if I have the sense to ask them for help, right? Which we just discussed that I don't always have. So sometimes it's like, you know, the client said, okay, let's do a campaign and we have to achieve this result. Well, we failed or we succeeded. Yay, high fives. But there's all these shades of gray. And so when you're doing a recap of a campaign or when you're doing an analysis midway through a campaign or through some project, I'm learning how to inject compassion and empathy in there to say, okay, let's not talk about the results. Let's just talk about how we're doing. You know, where do we all see room for improvement? Or, hey, why did we not hit this milestone that we were trying to hit? And what can we do now to go around it and still get to our end goal? And really more Socratic method than anything than trying to dictate what to do. It's more asking questions to get the young contributors on the team thinking the same way I'm thinking and make it constructive and not just to hear critique, which is really not helpful ultimately.
So I just actually gave a talk today at an event up in Dubai. And one of the concepts I talked about, and I said before I even started talking about it, I said, now listen, this is going to be a scary proposition. And for some of you, it's fearful. It's vulnerable, but it's actually being compassionate in the workplace. And it was like, that was one of the themes of the talk, you know? And it's a hard thing for men.
It is. Well, it's not even just men. I think women have it even worse because in light of everything that's happening out in the world today, I just, with a colleague yesterday, I had a talk with a woman who was being very direct. She didn't do anything that I would consider wrong. And somebody said, you're too aggressive. And it's like, no, she's not aggressive. If it was a male that was doing the same thing, we would have said, oh, good, you're assertive. I came up in a very traditional agency in Boston called Hill Holliday. And I had leaders and role models who were awesome people, men and women who were just really compassionate and caring. But they did not mince words when the work product was on the line. I mean, they were great people and generous and giving with their time. And they loved the people that worked for them and with them. But when it came to like, here's my layout, they'd be like, well, this looks like shit. No, this is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. And then when that's done, let's be compassionate and be buddies again. But there's no room for middle ground of soft selling when we're discussing the work product that we get paid to deliver to our clients.
Well, and I would just dovetail that a little bit by saying, you know, how you frame the problem, and I don't mean like talking around the problem, but how you frame the problem can have just as big of an impact as directly discussing the problem. I don't know if that makes sense, but like, you know, one of the things I was talking about today was this idea of we're in a yes culture where when you work in an organization, you feel like you have to say yes to everything. Yes, I'll do that project. Yes, I'll see you out tonight. Yes, I'll be on that committee. Yes, 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 yes. And what happens when you say all those yeses is that stuff starts to suffer somewhere along the way. And I said, the hardest thing to do is to say no, and to say no to your boss. Like, it's a really hard thing to do. But my argument is if you frame it in a way that shows that you're thinking of the benefit of him and the outcome for him, there's a way to frame that argument to say something to the effect of, listen, I really want to do this for you because I want to succeed and I want you to succeed. However, my plate's really full, so we either have to take something off my plate to do this, or you need to give this project to somebody else. Right.
Yeah. I'm always open to that kind of discussion where someone says, hey, I'm not going to be able to do my best work on this in it today. You know, if this can wait, I can do it. I really want to do it. Or what else? How can I reprioritize what I'm working on? I'm always open to that because I know I push really hard and I want to do everything all the time instantly. Right. That's the world that we live in. So
why do you think it's hard for people to have that conversation? Side note, did you just change your picture on Skype?
I had no idea. Like right when I logged on, I was like, oh, that's an old picture. I don't use Skype very much.
It
so,
just
yeah,
popped just, up to me and I was like, oh, that's a different picture. Anyhow, sorry.
Yeah, that was 7 years. That was young me. I thought, whoa, let me get one here with some gray. Let's go.
So
sorry about that.
No, that's all right. I don't care. I just noticed. I was like, wait, that's a different picture. Why do you think it's hard for people to have that conversation? Is it the boss? Is it the person? Is it a combination?
Well, I think people are fearful of saying no to someone that can control their career or to potentially fire them. I mean, I don't think I know I personally wouldn't just chase somebody out of the building for saying, hey, I can't get to that today. But if my opinion changes of somebody over time, that's not a good look for your career or, you know, knowing your next review's coming up. So I get why people are fearful of it. I know why I'm fearful sometimes of saying no to my CEO, even though he gives me a lot of latitude. But you want to say yes, you want to be person that people can count on, that people can go to. I think that's inside of everybody that has drive. And I don't think we as a culture in the U.S. especially know how to manage that drive and say, like, I still want to move forward, but I can say no to this thing and still be moving forward.
And do you think a lot of it is how you frame that conversation?
I think that's part of every conversation is how it's framed. I mean, you could say, sometimes somebody can say yes and piss you off. You know, you say, hey, can you do this? And they can frame yes in a way that you're like, wait a minute, what did you just say? And they're like, I said I was going to do it. But if they say it with a snotty attitude, and you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
So I think, right, I'm in the messaging business. I think everything is how it's framed.
Yeah. You know, what did you talked about that first company. Did you always want to be in advertising?
I always did. I don't know why or what drove me to do that. I always wanted to be in advertising and I didn't even know what that meant exactly.
So two things. One, I don't think art director is as obscure as planner. I think that's
I've been, that's as my career grows, like my titles get even more and more obscure and hard to understand.
Yeah. and then the other thing I was going to tell you is that this was one of my biggest mistakes I ever made. So I was living in Chicago at the time, and I had an interview at, oh my gosh, Leo Burnett. And I interviewed there. And I forget where which account it was on. It might have been Nintendo or Coors or Bud or one of those. But they had like free alcohol every Friday, and they had like game stations in the actual office, which was both awesome. And I interviewed for the job, and they offered me the job. But I was like, all right, so how much? And this is back in 1998.
Okay.
And they were like, yep, that'll be $18,000 a year. And I was like, what?
I'm like, isn't that crazy?
I'm like, I can't even live on that. Like, that's like not even livable money in Chicago.
What was the job?
I can't. I was something to do on like entry level account, something or other. Yeah. It was so long ago, but I remember I got the offer and they were like, yeah, it's $18,000. I was like, I would have to work a second job, and you expect me to work 90 hours a week already. So like,
I know that's the thing. Yeah, you won't have time to work a second job. That's the problem.
All right, I'm gonna pass.
It's supply and demand. There's so many people queued up for the jobs. It just dictates these low wages. Yeah. It's really crazy that people even stay hanging on for the 2 years that they have to endure that indentured servantship.
Well, and that's what he said. You hear 2 years, you almost double your salary. But I didn't have the foresight to look 2 years down the road at that age. My frontal lobe was way far behind in the development stage. So I didn't have that ability to be like, all right, it's only 2 years. It will suck. I was already barely getting by and surviving, like, to the nth degree.
No, I look at it the other way, James. I think you had the foresight to say, I can do more in those 2 years to put myself in a better position than make copies and, you know, take notes in meetings.
Yeah, but don't you think that there's something to be said about working for a global organization, or at least a large ad agency, from learning the processes?
It depends on the organization for sure. I was really lucky at Hill Holliday, and then I was recruited to J. Walter Thompson in New York.
Yeah.
And when I got there, that's a true global agency. At the time I worked, it was the biggest agency in the world. And wow, it was just a culture shock for me of how differently it ran. Talk about no compassion. I mean, it was cutthroat. It was dog eat dog. It was a big global holding company where, you know, every October they just cut staff to make their year end numbers. It was just a totally different animal.
What did you do at JWT?
I was a senior art director there. It was really dog eat dog. It was really different from what I had grown up with.
And so how did that, like, psychologically make you feel about the ad agency?
Yeah, that's good, very insightful of you. It made me very skeptical. I couldn't, every day I would go in and I couldn't reconcile, like, why are these people not cooperating? Why aren't we working together? Why isn't this more, this could be fun. This job is supposed to be fun. And it was very much like, don't look over my shoulder. I'm doing this over here, and this is my project, and I don't want you to do it.
And it would seem to me that collaboration is the key to success in any ad agency anyways.
Well, when you have halls and halls that in that building, you know, I think it was the seventh floor that was all creative people. And it's not just at that time, at that place, it wasn't just some creative people. It was the best, most creative, talented, skilled people. If they could have brought those brains together, it would have been an unstoppable force. But instead, they, divided everybody up. Everybody had an office with a door that, you know, at 10 a.m. when people rolled in, they were closed. And actually, over the time that I was there, they started knocking down some of the walls. And then after I left and moved to Scottsdale, a new regime came in and they knocked down more of the walls and made it more open. And I think they were trying to get to that same idea that I felt, which was, you know, why are we closing all this off and cornering everybody out when we could be bringing people together?
So did you always feel like when you were in that environment? Because, like, I don't feel like I'd fit in that environment either. Like, I'm a pretty bubbly guy. I'm not overly competitive in that capacity. Did you feel like a square in a round hole, or a peg in a round hole?
Yeah, in that environment, I didn't work for me. In Boston, it was a different.
Yeah. So why did you make the change? Just because it seemed like a better opportunity?
Well, ironically, I thought I was moving home. I thought, oh, this will be great. I'll get back to New York. I'll be moving home. I'll be seeing close to my parents. The night I got there for my interview, I met my wife. I came back to New York to be home, and then we ended up leaving, you know, two and a half years later to across the country. So, whoops.
So now when you met your wife and you guys decided to get married and move to Scottsdale, did you then also feel like a fish out of water in Scottsdale, or did you feel like the pace better suit you?
It took a long time to wash the New York. I mean, I really missed it. And I jumped in with both feet. I mean, I didn't kick and fight and say, I don't want to do this. I jumped in and said, all right, I understand. Like, I knew why we were doing it. And I agreed that what kind of life I wanted to have, but, and the kind of family we wanted to build, we are in lockstep. But from an industry standpoint, it took me years, 5, 6, 7 years. In fact, we moved from Scottsdale after a couple of years to Atlanta for 2 or 3 years to try something else. And it wasn't until we got to Atlanta that I was like, oh, actually Scottsdale is awesome. And I don't even miss New York, you know, I liked Atlanta a lot, but there was just some things about it that were real challenging and different from Scottsdale is just an easy place to live. It's, you know, all the roads are on a grid. There's hardly ever traffic. The weather is amazing.
So talk to me about how you ended up back at Santee. Cause I'm guessing you said you were at Santee, you left to go to Verizon and all those other places over there, and then back to Santee.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Now at this point, so it was really, at this point, let me quickly ask, did you have any kids at this point?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We had both our kids, when we lived in Scottsdale before we moved to Atlanta. Yeah. And then we moved to Atlanta when I think James was 1 year or maybe 2 years old when we got to Atlanta.
So let me ask you a question as a dad then, like, what were your expectations before you had James? And were those expectations what you thought they were going to be after you had James?
My expectations of what specifically? Of
just having a baby in the house, like just being a dad.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, he was my second. So Emily's my first.
Sorry, we'll go with Emily on that in this example.
It didn't, you know, when you're a dad, this is kind of a funny thing about being a dad. You don't really matter until they're 2 or 3 years old. You're sort of irrelevant because I can feed them a bottle, but they don't depend on my body.
Yeah.
Like they do the mom. And so a lot of dads, when I talk to dads and they're being candid, they say, you know, I really didn't connect with them until they could talk or until they could walk or until they could like hold a ball.
Yeah.
I was really on top of my kids and trying to connect with them early on. But I think there's some truth to until they get a little bit more interactive and until you're teaching them things or able to have a conversation with them, it's harder for a father to connect in a weird way.
Was it what you thought it would be being a dad, like initially, or did you not have any?
I don't know if I had any preconceived notion of it. I mean, I'm still trying to, kids are 7 and 9. I'm still figuring it out every day.
Have you guys decided to tap out? I'm done.
Yeah. As soon as James came out and he had 10 fingers and 10 toes, we said, we're done. Yeah. That's it.
You know, when my daughter came out, this is the second one. So I have 2 daughters, 2 sons. She came out. So we're super excited, right? And all of a sudden you hear code red. And we're like, what?
Oh God.
And that's like the one word you don't want to hear.
Right. It's the only thing you know about medicine is that's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Every show on ER taught me that code red.
Yeah. Right. And if someone's yelling stat, then you know, just get down and don't look.
And, so she came out not breathing. Like she wasn't breathing. She had a club foot and, all of a sudden I was just like, the moment of shock is unbelievable in your life. Like you're like, oh my God. Oh my God. And you hear you hear the nurse going, come on, what's her name? What's her name? We hadn't given her a name yet. My wife just blurted out Lucy. And so she's like, here we go, Lucy. Here we go, Lucy. Okay, come on, baby. Come on, baby. And obviously she comes around and she starts, you know, starts breathing. But man, that was the scariest probably 2 minutes of my life. You're like,
yeah, that was your oldest?
My second.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's scary.
Yeah. That was intense. That was super intense. All right. So now let me get back to the question of how you ended up back at Santee, after Atlanta. So
yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So you left Santee. Did you leave? Obviously you left on good terms.
I did. Yeah. I left on good terms. The agency had taken a turn and
was really about 2009.
It was like around 11.
11. Okay.
2011. It was really about personal growth, going and leaving and, you know, trying to do something else. So I had always talked about it. Like I said, I didn't appreciate Arizona or Scottsdale for everything it was giving me. And so when I went to Atlanta, it was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Right. You don't like it here.
Yeah.
In the state. So after a year, not even, I mean, I had always stayed in touch with Dan Santee, who's the CEO and founder here, and just a great friend to me, as well as my boss. Always stayed in touch with him. You know, we always chatted, you know, stayed abreast of what he was doing here with the company. And after a year there, when the first agency in Atlanta folded and I took the job at Verizon, I had been talking to him and I was just burned out on being a creative. And I thought I had really put the failure of that office on my own shoulders. I just said, well, maybe I'm just not really good as a creative director. I mean, maybe this is 100% my fault. It's definitely some part my fault. So I was really burned out and I had called him and, you know, we were talking and he was kind of counseling me while I was looking for a job there. And I started at Verizon and really like 2 weeks into my job at Verizon, I just said, wow, this isn't for me. I, you know, I can make it work and I could figure out how to move up the corporate ladder, but that's not who I am. I don't really want to do that. And so we stayed in touch and we're talking and he said, hey, you know, you'd be welcome back here, but I already have a creative director. And I was like, yes. I said, that's perfect. Cause I don't want to do that job anymore. I'm burned. I'm not good at it. You know, there's parts of it that I was really good at it and parts of it I just clearly was just not, achieving at. And so what we agreed to do over time, we kept talking and, one of us came up with the idea, hey, let's both go write a job description. You write the job description of the job you want, and I'll write the job description of the job I need here, like the role that I need in the company to help me get to where I want to go. And they were essentially the same description. I mean, it was like very close, maybe 3/4 overlap of what those skills were. And I had been lucky because I was never a planner. I was never a strategist. I was never trained. But when I was a CD at Santee the first time, I partnered up with the media director that was here. I partnered up with the account director that was here. I worked really closely with the clients and I was always able to ask detailed questions about their business that would inform the creative work. And I was really much more interested in that than, you know, the creative side of it, just the beauty of the creative part of it. And so coming back as a strategy director was, number one, like, wow, what a gift that somebody took a chance. But it just, as soon as I started doing it, I had a client in Atlanta that I was still working with, from the agency, but also doing some freelance with and still work with now. And I told her about it and she's like, oh, you're going to kill it. She's like, I don't even know. You're more of a planner than you were a creative anyway. And I was like, oh, that's refreshing to hear because, you know, you're always uncertain when you're making those big moves. So it was really, that's what brought me back and it's been 4 years. And, that was kind of the thinking behind the book that, you know, it doesn't all have to be this highbrow come from this real training place. Cause I never got any training. It's just these basic tenets to keep in mind.
All right. Well, let's turn to your book. So your book is titled, Underthink It, the Marketing Strategy Guidebook for Everyone. So tell me, it just came out, I mean, November 5th. I mean, this thing is fresh off the hot press at this point.
Yes, it's still smoking.
I see it from here, just so you know. and so the book is laid out quite simple for the most part. I mean, it's a 13-chapter book. Tell me what was the impetus of writing this book? Like what makes Adam, you know, the guy to write this book?
Well, that's a great question. I wrote it because I had my annual review and I was being challenged by Dan to train my team. You know, I have a great team of strategists and we're growing. And they said, how come you haven't put together a training curriculum to get your team up to the next level they need to be at? And I thought, well, that is a very fair comment. but I've never received any training. So I don't know where to start. So I took the direction and I went back to my desk and I just started Googling and I thought, well, you know what I'll do? I'll find a conference or I'll find a seminar or I'll find a book or something that I can at least start with, you know, and they'll get exposed to all these ideas and I'll be done. Right. But as it turns out, I couldn't find one. And a couple days later, I was still searching, couldn't find one. And what I did, I started reaching out on Twitter and LinkedIn to planners and strategists I know from across the country and around the world and said, hey, how are you training your team? How are you trained? And they all responded back and said, when you find it, let me know. And so they were all looking for the same thing. And they said, well, here's one good thing, but I can't find anything comprehensive like what you're talking about. And so I started to put together bookmarks of, you know, oh, this is a good article and this is a good book. And the book list essentially is the bibliography of Underthink It. But, you know, here's a webinar, here's a seminar, here's, you know, and I started to put this whole thing together. And then I started moving around the order and I realized, oh yeah, this is the comprehensive thing. I didn't invent any of these tools, but these are the tools that I use. And so I started to share them with my team and I realized, you know, there's a need for this. Nobody has this list. And so, you know, we call it a marketing guidebook because the way I want people to use it, you can read it. And James, if you've skimmed it even, it's really breezy. It's meant to be easy to read. Part of the takeaway is people in strategy, unfortunately, and I've been guilty of this too. Like we come in and we use these huge words, you know, 5-syllable words. We're sounding, we want to sound so smart. We want to earn credibility by sounding like we're borrowing these terms from academia. We want to make it sound like, oh yeah, and this is scientific. But the truth is all of those big words make it hard for people around you to understand what the hell you're talking about. And so the book is actually written in a way that's really simple, down to earth language. I had the editors go through, and if I used a word that was too big, they crossed it out and left it in there to embarrass me and put in a smaller word that was a better substitute after it. So, you know, just to dumb down the language and make it easier for people to get through and make it easier to understand, because the goal of the book is for people to go through, use it, dog ear pages or circle things in it. And when you get stuck on a project, go back and say, okay, let's go back to how decisions get made chapter, or let's go back and look at media and figure out, you know, where we're stuck and does this spark any ideas? So it's meant to be, you know, something that you can read pretty quickly, like in a weekend, but also to be something that stays on your desk and can become a tool that you go back to as you need it.
It seems to me that it's very much focused in your space, right? In your context. I mean, when you look at just simply the index, right? It's when you talk about the three phases of strategy, the foundational, the campaign, the post-campaign. So would you say this is mostly targeted towards those who work in the ad industry?
It's for specifically people inside agencies, so either planners or account execs, people responsible for developing strategy and briefs, and that varies by agency and even by discipline within an agency, just how people are trained. And then we've also had really good feedback from in-house agencies, so people that are working inside of a brand that operate in the same way as an agency or share the same principles. Mm-hmm. And those three phases are, yeah, they're pretty specific to agency world, but the foundational phase is all the brand work and understanding who the customer is and, you know, what kind of value can the customer expect from this brand. And then the campaign is really about how do you write a creative brief? And then finally, post-campaign is did this work? You know, how do we know if the campaign was successful and what are we going to do from here?
I ask this of everybody. So Adam, for where you're at, what you do, and who you are, how do you define happiness?
Yeah, happiness is an elusive son of a gun. I really define it as being of one mind with my family and moving things forward and being productive at the other parts of my life. That's really how I've boiled it down. Knowing you were going to ask me that, I tried to get it down into one sentence. That's pretty much the best way to do it.
No, I think what I should start asking people to do is write that down, and I want to talk to them in 10 years from now to see if that definition has changed.
I think mine is pretty straightforward. I think it'll hold.
We will see about that. I will talk to you in 10 years, mister.
I put it on the calendar. Yeah.
Well, listen, Adam. Oh, geez. Now I'm worried about your last name. Adam Pierno. Jeez. I like psych myself out about it. I'm like, oh, God, I'm going to fuck this up for sure. Adam Pierno.
It's a tricky one.
Nah, it's not that bad. It's pretty phonetically there. If you can say Pierno. Pierno. So, Adam Pierno, thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Awesome. Have a great day.